another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're continuing our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. I just spent the morning finishing the recent book by our guest today, Reverend Nemu, and the book's called Science Revealed. I actually got an earlier version of the book called Nemu's End, History, Psychology, and Poetry of the Apocalypse, which is a marvel of visionary, underground, super smart, pretty darn entertaining and poetic mania. The only complaint I had was that it was sort of all over the place and not quite edited, and so I was incredibly happy to find out that the good reverend has decided to go back to the, not to the drawing board, but to the, I don't know what you call it, the word processor, and to refine and crystallize this crazy tome into three, count them, three books around this topic of the apocalypse. And just to jump the gun a bit, we got to remind everyone right here that apocalypse does not mean the catastrophic end of the world. Apocalypse etymologically means revelation, and even the Christians, you say revelation, they think, oh my God, the end of the world, the mark of the beast, great Babylon, tribulation, that whole thing, right? But it means revelation. It means unveiling, seeing, and insight. So it can also have a very positive connotation, or a sort of total visionary connotation, as well as a sense of a potentially catastrophic shift. So we'll get that one out of the way. And it, actually, let's bring on Maja right now, because she's so good at this apocalypse stuff. And I'm already too, I was kind of like taking a page from your book, because you usually do the etymology. And but you can also help us understand this sense of apocalypse. You mentioned that right now, as we speak, there's always these signs that kind of come and go, you know, some moments that seem more edgy with a kind of collective, if not cosmic, sense of potential revelation and transformation, and that at least astrologically, if I gathered, right now is one of those times.
It totally is, Eric. I mean, we come into these times, like you said, often enough that I would hope people understand that apocalypse doesn't mean the end of the world, because if you look at the apocalypses that have occurred, the world still exists. But right now, the one that we're facing is this series of four blood moons. And if you Google the four blood moons, they're starting this 15th of April. The first blood moon is in Libra, and it's where the blood, the moon turns bright red. Literally, you can see it. The color of it becomes that. It's not just a metaphorical thing. And there's a sequential order of four of them that meet with Passover. So this is like an old prophecy. This isn't like a New Agey thing. This is like a Bible thing, you know?
Well, what makes the moon red? I mean, it's like scientists agree the moon will be slightly red.
I know, right? You can go on the NASA website. They do a much better job of explaining it. If you Google Blood Moon NASA, it explains the phenomenon in a better way I can do than on that for you.
No, that's fair. That's fair.
So one of the things I've been researching with it is the idea of the, like you said, the Whore of Babylon, right? It's Babylon, which, of course, for all the Crowleyites, Babylon is the opening or unveiling. It has that connotation of the feminine or Isis energy pulling off the veil that is the real world, right? Meaning like our physical, material, Maya existence. So this whole thing with the Scarlet Woman, I've been researching a lot with these blood moons, and I do feel very much like you said, it's not about natural disasters and stuff like that, although sometimes those do occur in apocalyptic times and have, you know, like look at earthquakes and stuff like that affiliated with some of these moons. like how March 11th, when there was the Fukushima one that tied into the supermoon that was all apocalyptic too. So, I mean, sometimes there can be some real physical natural energies affiliated with it as well. But for this one, I do, much like you, I think there's going to be some revelations about maybe nature, like maybe we'll have some huge scientific progress, or people will just, like, come clean about some of their old standing, you know, bull crap they've been hanging on to for a long time.
Well, that, that's one of the ways that I've come to think about it, and this will just lead into naturally into conversation with the Reverend, is that apocalypse can be collective in the sense of some great secret coming out to bear. Like, I've been doing research on the early 70s and reading about Watergate, you know, and suddenly everybody in the nation has to confront the fact that the president was doing this incredibly, organizing this incredibly paranoid, nasty, illegal, cheesy, sleazy operation, and it was just so shocking to everybody. It's that sort of like this, like, kind of a collective revelation that really shifts political reality, social reality. But there's also a personal apocalypse that we ourselves can have these revelatory moments, not necessarily huge visionary downloads, although those count. That's certainly what motivates, like, revelation in the Bible. That's St. John sitting on an island, and he gets a vision. Now, maybe that's a literary genre. Maybe the guy's actually saying what he saw. Maybe it's a mixture of the two. But there's a sense that we, inside ourselves, psychologically as well as spiritually, have these insights that have a drastic quality of sort of reorganizing the whole space. And so then the real interesting question, and this is the lead into the Reverend, is the relationship between the personal apocalypse and the collective apocalypse. So with that, Reverend, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Very good to be here. Hello, Eric, and hello, Marga.
Great. Can you speak up a little bit? It's a little muddy to my ear.
Yeah, okay, you're quite quiet there. Is that better?
Yeah, it's better.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, God, there's so much stuff to start with, but before we get to the kind of big ideas that you're playing with in the whole trilogy, but particularly in this first volume, which is kind of focused on science and inspiration and different ways of thinking about claims about reality, especially in our scientific age, supposedly scientific age. You've also just led a really remarkable life, and that's part of what animates these this you know, in some ways very heady but always very fun to read explorations that you've got. I mean, you talk about your 6 years in Japan. You've lived in traveled to India. You've been to lived for quite a while in South America. And I'm just kind of curious how you got started, how you became a wanderer. Like, what was it that led you away from the UK? What kept you going year after year through your cross, you know, your international adventures?
Right. I've been very lucky. I had, just in my last year at university, I was crossing the road one afternoon, and right in the middle of the road, I bumped into a friend of mine. And it transpired that he was going to a certain department of the university to collect some documents to show that he was doing a degree. And he said it was for an interview that he was going to regarding a trip to Japan. And he said, why don't you come to Japan? And I thought that was a very good idea. So it was a complete fluke that it was Friday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and that particular office was closing in 2 hours. So it was the last minute that I could have possibly got on that particular scheme to go to Japan, which took me there for, it was a one-year contract, and then I extended. I lived in Fukushima before they had their own apocalypse there for a couple of years, and then I just ended up staying because it was just such an extraordinary place, and the people behaved in such an interesting fashion. So that took me there, and then I stayed there for 6 years. I got married for a time, and then that fell apart. And by the time I was, by that time, I'd already been introduced to a particular lineage of ayahuasca, ayahuasca ceremony.
Are you talking about the Santo Daime? So you first had a Santo Daime. You first encountered this the Daime in Japan.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, could you talk a little bit? This is I think one of the major sort of spiritual influences, events in your life. Can you just to bring people up to snuff, say a little bit about what the diamond is and what you discovered when you went to the source?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I didn't know anything about the diamond when I first heard about it. In fact, my ex-wife said, "Would you like to come to a crazy drugs party?" And I said, "Of course." And she couldn't really explain it much better than that. Her English wasn't too good at the time, and my Japanese wasn't too good at the time. So I went along to discover it was, men in shirts and ties and blue slacks and women in blue skirts, and separated the one from, the ladies on one side and the men on the other, and incense and crosses. And I found the only other foreigner in the room, and I asked him, I said, "Is this some kind of a church?" And he answered, "Yes." He said, it's a funky church. and he was right. So I didn't know anything about it, and it kind of alarmed me at the time, I must say. But very quickly, the kind of entities which are invited into that place are very much bigger than the ideas of those entities. So if you're talking about the Virgin Mary, for example, we've all got a very... An idea of what the Virgin Mary is and what she means, but the particular ceremony of Daimi in the sacrament that we use, which is ayahuasca, opens a very much broader perspective on what that entity is, and a whole lot of other entities as well.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about this, in a bit. But another story I'd love to pull out of you, because it's one of the things that when we met, you told me about and really helped me kind of see something very specific about you, and also about how you've come to live your life and to integrate the values into the decisions that you make in difficult as well as glorious ways. And this is this horrible malady you came down with when you were in the jungle, and the ways that you chose to treat that, and what that process of illness and healing taught you, and where it led you, because it seems to be very much bound up with some of the fundamental motivations that I see in your writing and in your work.
It's certainly important. So fast forward a number of years, I left Japan, I went to Brazil, and I hadn't been there very long, and I was in the Amazon, and I got bitten by a sandfly. I got bitten on the chest. And it turned into a spot which continued to grow and grow until it became this rather nasty pus-filled ulcer. And it's called leishmaniasis, and it's endemic to the region, and it's quite a serious disease. It has a number of different phases. In the first phase, it produces ulcers, and in the second phase, it can start to attack the cartilage in your nose and in your ears. And if you want to see something awful, just Google leishmaniasis and you'll see all kinds of disfigured people. But it came along at a very very interesting time for me. I was editing that first massive tome that landed with you some years ago, and that book grew out of a really deep interest in different cosmologies, different medical cosmologies, and how different people interpret disease and health and the body and that, because you can get a real insight into what people really think when it comes to something which threatens their life and limb. You know, people can say all kinds of things about what they think, but you really see what they think when they're, when there's disease involved. So I've always been interested in medicine. I've been interested in various forms of medicine. My mum's an acupuncturist and my sister's a doctor. And I'm also interested in the colonial aspects of medicine and the real politics involved in spreading different forms of medicine. So when that particular malady struck me, everyone around me kind of freaked out, and they told me to go and have injections of antimonium tartrate, which is a heavy metal. And normally you would have about 150 injections, three a day into your veins, and possibly more, 180, 220, whatever it took before the ulcer dried up. And like everyone around me, all the doctors and every medical alternative medic around me, and all my neighbors as well, the Amazonians there, because I was living in the jungle, not far into the jungle, but I was living in the jungle, they all freaked out and they told me I had to go and do this. And I kind of, I had an academic perspective on how Occidental interventionist medicine was displacing traditional modalities. And so I didn't really believe that, because I'd looked into it. And also, I was quite scared, because it's quite serious business. So what I did was I went and I drank a dose of diamine, and I had a vision which basically made it quite clear what my understanding of disease was. And, you know, I think things happen for a reason in the shamanic tradition. Certainly, a disease can be considered as an invading spirit, or in Christian tradition, there's a great deal of emphasis put on suffering and redemption. And suffering is one of those things that's quite important in a lot of traditions, the Buddhist tradition as well. And it's part of life. It's part of the full spectrum of life. And a full life lived to its full can give you all kinds of opportunities for revelation. And that was really what I was after. And I'd gone there very specifically to learn about diving and to learn what it was capable of. And that's what I saw in my vision. I saw that this was an opportunity for me to see actually what it was capable of. And also, if the book that I'd been writing for the previous 6 years was just a load of nonsense, really, or if it had any truth to it.
Well, that's one of the things I remarked on this morning when I was reading, where you talk about your illness in a wonderful chapter about homeopathy and science and how we think about healing. And you made the point that if you're, you know, working with these ideas and you're interested in these alternative modalities, and you see the politics of health, and you see the deeper sort of religious or spiritual paradigms that are motivating these different kind of these views, and including the political conflict, that you couldn't really stand, you couldn't really publish this book. You didn't feel like the vision that you were creating, partly intellectually, partly out of your research and your interests, would really be realized unless you walk the walk. And to me, that's a really remarkable thing. We see far too little of that. It's much easier to imagine the more ordinary human situation, where as soon as the concrete conditions of your life are hitting against your ideals, you kind of try to sneak away from the ideal. Maybe you don't say anything. Maybe you just kind of create some rationalization. Well, the doctors told me, or even the people living there were saying, hey, get the shot, you know, come on, don't screw around. So it was a remarkable bit of, I don't know what to call it, just this kind of existential, creative, brilliant, foolhardy act, and it does seem to have led you to a deeper place.
Yeah, I mean, it was on the back of, I'd already been involved in that tradition for, I think, 6 years at that time, and it wasn't out of nowhere. It was on the back of quite a lot of magic that had happened through Daimi, and all kinds of extraordinary synchronicities, and, I didn't have any good reason to doubt that there was a lot of magic going on. All the way through the story of diamine for me, and not just diamine as well. I've been interested in all kinds of other interesting and weird mysticisms. So it wasn't out of nowhere, and it just seemed very apropos to the moment. And that's kind of important, like the meaning of a moment and the poetry of a moment, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and then talk a little bit more also about the diamine, which is, this increasingly, recognized part of global religious diversity. You know, people in Europe and in the United States, as well, of course, from people from Brazil, which has this rich and very diverse set of practices and groups within just the lineage of Dimey, and it presents a somewhat different picture than the more than the sort of partly fantasy or vision of the kind of indigenous model of ayahuasca use and the kinds of mestizo slash indigenous forms that a lot of people are familiar with. So what was it about Dimey and its form, its in some ways more Brazilian structure that, you know, more modern, more influenced by Christianity, by urban reality, et cetera. What was it about that form that has kept you with it?
It's a good question. It's kind of the place it arose from, or the time it arose, was in the early part of last century, and in a matrix of Rio Branco, and in a real no man's land, a part of the world which was neither Bolivia really nor Brazil, and there were kind of border disputes going on, and out of this area, which was kind of unpoliced in a way, this man called Irineo Serra, or Mestre Irineo as we call him, he contacted the Indian tribes there, or some of them, and he started drinking ayahuasca. And he brought it out of that particular context into a an esoteric, they call it folk Catholic tradition. So it's Catholicism, but it's quite a long way from the Vatican. And Brazilian Catholicism, you know, it has all kinds of different things going on in it. Anyway, it has Yemanjá, who's almost been imported into the popular belief system. So it's a collective rite, whereas the shamanism, as it's practiced in some of the original, well, I don't know if the original is the right word, but in a traditional context, it tends to be something where a shaman will drink on his own or her own and bring back some news for the patient, or you have a kind of a model which is quite influenced by ayahuasca tourism, where a bunch of people will go along and drink as well. But it's certainly not a collective rite. And this is Dimey is a collective rite. You do a session on the 15th and 30th of every month, which is a meditation session of about 2 hours. And then you have the Saints' Days celebrated throughout the year, which are with it's called a bailado, but it's a dance work. So you have the men on one side and the women on the other, and they're dancing in a kind of repetitive way to a repetitive beat, and it'll go on for, I mean, it could be a 12-hour ceremony, just singing for all that time. And, I mean, the ceremony on its own, even without the ayahuasca, is pretty strong. You know, and we've done them in England, because we're now we can't practice in this country anymore because of legal difficulties. But for a time, we were doing sessions just with water, and it's immensely strong just to get into a large group of people and just kind of do a two-step from side to side for a very long time. And then with the addition of the ayahuasca into that format, it becomes an extraordinarily powerful thing. And people from the more neo-ayahuasca tradition sometimes say, well, I don't want to do that, where, you know, you have to be really regimented. It is very regimented. The lines are kept tight, and everyone has to play the maraca, the maraca. So you have to keep in time, and you have to keep present in all moments. So you're beating a maraca twice a second all the way through the day and the night. And I kind of describe it like this. If you want to launch a rocket into orbit, you don't want the panels flapping around or kind of bits hanging off. You want the whole thing to be streamlined. And Dimey, when it's practiced correctly, or it's practiced in the form that I like it, and I'm quite old school about these things. I like the Amazonian way of doing things. It's a very, very streamlined, very, very tight thing. And what you're looking for as well is you're looking for uniformity. So you're all singing the same thing. You're all singing the same melody. There's no harmonies. And kind of within that uniformity, you can access levels which I don't know. I don't have any experience in the shamanic tradition, or very, very little. But certainly the planes of consciousness which you can access through that, whilst you're dancing, whilst you're moving, or whilst you're playing guitar or whatever you're doing, are just wonderful. And also, there's something about the fact that it's halfway between the Western and the Occidental and the shamanic way. It seems to be a compromise isn't the right word. It seems to be a very nice syncretism.
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, it's more in line with what I would call esotericism than indigenous shamanism in that way. It resonates more. And it's also interesting just thinking about the collective. I mean, I think that a lot of people who are drawn to this kind of work and a lot of people who are, you know, seeking for spiritual insight, for, you know, a larger view to integrate into our kind of fragmented world, you know, they're attracted to forms, to religious forms, but there's also this kind of leeriness about truly collective ritual, that it has to be kind of free, you know, you're still kind of got to be on your own. You got to have that sort of singular quality, such a sign of our, you know, post-60s pluralism. And you're pointing towards another possibility of that, you know, inside a form, this rocket ship metaphor is really wonderful. But what interests me is that even though you are more of a let's call it a devotee of a certain religious form of spirit, working with spiritual forces, higher planes, etc., that it's almost like that has allowed you to be a very free thinker and writer in your text. It's not like you're writing from a Daime perspective or you know, esoteric Catholic perspective or anything like that. If anything, one of the things I really enjoy about your writing is it's very playful. You move quickly between different frames of reference, but it all sort of fits into a story. You're very pungent and tart about certain things that you think are rotten, and then you'll make a turn away from the usual. There's so much pessimism and darkness these days, so much dark side apocalypse, and you have this kind of lighter quality of pointing to possibility, even though you see all the stuff that's going on. So how does this writing work? Like what role does writing have? This great text and reworking it now, you've been working on it for such a long period of time now. What role has it played in your own evolution?
Yeah, again, very important. I've been writing fairly compulsively since I was small. I wrote shelves and shelves of diaries, and it never seems to... With a lot of ideas going on in my head, I could really work out what I was thinking about something by writing it, and if there was any kind of integral sense to it by writing it down. And so I'd written for quite a long time, and then, again, sparked by a dining experience that I had in Japan, I got into a habit of compulsive writing at night. So I'd been insomniac for most of my life, and I'm not an insomniac anymore, although I do stay up quite late. But so I've been an insomniac, and I started getting these very strong urges to write, and these kind of scraps of text all would come through in the early hours of the morning. And in fact, that's where the name comes from. The name Nemu was the name of my ex-wife's kind of elephant sleeping teddy bear. It was called Nemu Nemu. And so it was basically me and him up at night whilst the rest of the house was asleep, and writing away. And so I had all these texts, and they all went into into an envelope. And then a friend of mine had seen something I'd written on the internet, and she asked me if I had written any more. And I said, well, I've just got these scraps here. And she asked to read them, and then she quite enjoyed them and came around and started organizing them into various different categories, and that's where the book grew out of. So the writing has always been a way to kind of, I guess, get the chaos into a little bit of order, and it's also there's something alchemical about writing. It's a kind of constant process of refining and melting it together and breaking it up again when you're working towards getting your piece as perfect as you can. And I don't know if you're familiar with the mage card in, I mean, we were talking about Babylon a little while ago, but in the soft deck, the mage card has, right at the top of all the things he's juggling a pen and a scroll. And there's something very magical about writing, about writing your own world, really. And if it fits together beautifully and poetically, I think it develops a power of its own.
And yeah, very much so. And just to highlight, for me, I'm particularly moved by texts that have that alchemical, magical quality, associations, creative thinking, but are also really engaging with real-world issues, with politics, with science, yeah, with medicine, with cultural history, with philosophy, with, you know, that are not just sort of going in their own kind of poetic world, which is wonderful. I like that stuff too. But what I really enjoy is bringing that alchemical imagination, as you've done, into, you know, the I don't want to say the real world, but the world of politics and culture and science and biology and being willing to do the research and be online and, you know, download obscure scientific papers and know how to cite them and put them in the back of your book so you can see where the source of the claim comes from. Like, all of that work really puts your writing on a whole other level. But because it's also alchemical, it's even more, you know, delightful and delicious, because those two worlds are, of course, ultimately not separate. But anyway, we're going to take a break right now, and you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Reverend Nemu about Science Revealed and the Apocalypse. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, here with the illustrious Eric Davis. We are speaking with Reverend Nemu today about the apocalypse and revelations and how these things can occur. And before the break, Reverend, you were speaking a little bit about the power and magic of writing. And of course, as a witch, I do a lot of spelling words myself. And I do feel like, you know, you can look throughout history and see that kind of invocation method that writing can have in terms of, like, I think, acquiring our own revelations. And I wonder, so you talked a little bit about some of the practices that can enable the revelations to kind of come through, right? Like, we can do dances, chanting, writing. There's, like, these techniques that we can kind of engage in either on our own, as in writing, or in groups, like when we do the dancing together. And I wonder if you can maybe talk a little bit about, I mean, obviously, I think it has to be like a little bit of both those things happening, where we do those group techniques and do things on our own. But have you, like, in your experiences, found any particular kind of methodology? Like, for example, when you did get sick, when you incurred that disease, was there, like, have you nailed, like, a way for you to get into your revelations easier, or do you have any control over it? Does it just come in when you achieve a certain state, or can you, like, maybe talk a little bit about what you found to be the most conducive to kind of, like, get in the spot, so to speak?
Yes, right, yes, good question. Definitely the night. There's something about the hours of between about 2... and onwards, really, about 2 to about 5 in the morning, which has a really good effect on writing for me. And there's also this interplay between the conscious and the unconscious. So if I'm trying to work on something, and my writing for me is my practice. I do other things as well. I do meditation. I do this and that. But really, the writing where it's at. I've got a magic pen which no one else is allowed to touch. And so what I find if I'm writing something, if I want to write something, is I'll get some ideas down maybe at the beginning of the week, and then I'll have another look at them a couple of days later, and then I'll kind of wait for a certain a mood to come over me, a certain compulsion. and then I'll just get writing, and I'll the final bit of it, which seems it's not exactly automatic writing, but it's a certain zone which things flow very much quicker. And I'll tell you something else about magic and writing. I did this one particular write, which was it was nothing to do with Dimey. And it involved a circle and some other things. But the how do I put it? The litany of it was a poem that I'd written in that form that I just described to you. Like I wrote it a bit, I wrote it a bit again, and then I went back to it and kind of it all flooded out very quickly. And it was a written piece, and the thing was about writing. It was actually about helping me edit that massive poem into the three books which are going to be coming out, or the one that's out and the other two which are out. But what I found was in the morning after that session, I started doing joined-up writing again, which hadn't, you know, I'm a teacher, so I'm quite often, in fact, the whole time, I'm printing, just doing letters, and the fluidity of my writing had changed overnight. And it was wonderful. I'd say that, and also there's this other kind of, I guess it's what Borges called the angel of the library,
right.
Which also seems to pop in quite a lot. The exact text that I will require will be sitting on a train, or somehow the world will offer its assistance to my. To my writing process. So, like, for example, one time I was in Bolivia, and I'd been doing this one chapter of the second book, which goes into Adam and Eve and the serpent and all those crazy cats from Genesis. And a madman in the street walked up to me and started telling me, started talking about the apple and how he'd eaten it, and just started really ranting at me in the street. And I've often found in quite often through the words of mad people I've bumped into, but all the time this kind of constant weaving seems to happen between the written and between the lived, if that makes
sense.
Yeah,
totally. I had a similar experience happen to me. This guy I was dating, I was talking about Archangel Michael to him, explaining what it is, and I wrote him down a note about Archangel Michael, what it is. We left his apartment. Within minutes, a homeless, you know, maniac, like you said, like someone crazy or however we want to perceive that, starts talking to us about Archangel Michael. And like with the words that he said were so specific to our conversation, it was ridiculous. And it usually happens quickly, right? I mean, with you, with your experience, do you find like it's not like there'll be a huge gap, right?
Mm. Yeah, it happened quickly, and it happened quite poetically. There'll often be a kind
right.
of sense of humor there somewhere. And I guess that's part of the reason why I chose to not have those injections and to do what I'd written about in the book, because that interweaving of life and word had always, you know, it was a theme that had gone through my life. And it goes through the life of many writers, actually. I was talking to this one Bolivian guy. He was telling me a story of a book that a friend of his had written about people going into a cowboy town where he lived, and basically what had happened was he'd gone with the writer to this cowboy town, and the entire series of events of one of his books had happened. You know, they'd hitchhiked in, they'd been drinking in a bar, they'd gone to a fight, someone had been stabbed, they got chased, and when this writer in real life looked over to my friend, who woke up. He'd woken up. He'd been asleep when the fight started, and he had blood dripping down his hand. And he looked over to him and says, "Now do you see that you have to write in blood?" And then they legged it, and then they had to hide all night. And, you know, kind of crazy story right out of the book that this guy had written 10 years previously.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this connection we're talking about right here is actually one of the keys to the enigma of synchronicity in people's lives. Like, I think a lot of people think about, you know, synchronicities as just these extraordinary coincidences, and that they must imply something more. And, you know, we could talk about different theories of how they arise and why they arise. But I think one way into this that's nearer to hand is to just start to look at the way that if you are a reader, and a writer, particularly. That means you're working, you're crafting within the matrix of the infinite library, Borges's library, that these kinds of experiences just happen. Even very secular people not interested in spiritual events will talk about coming across some just the right bit of information at right the right time, et cetera, et cetera. And there's this way in which books talk to other books, and you kind of like fall into that conversation. And then that helps you sort of see even other kinds of synchronicities, that part of what the world revealed, if you will, by the synchronicity, or implied is better, because it doesn't quite reveal. It's always veiled as well as suggestive of a deeper meaning. To me, it's the world as a narrative, as a story. The world as a meaning-making story is what you glimpse in those strange kinds of coincidences, that other level of meaning is sort of, it has something very deeply connected to it about story, about writing, about text. So like reading and writing is a really interesting way in to synchronicity, which then can go much farther, until then you're inside somebody else's novel, but you don't know who's writing it or if you want them to go. Could you make a story go in another direction? I mean, you know, all sorts of ways open up with synchronicity, but they also make good, you know, can make really wonderful books as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a long time in the making, and I'm pleased to get the first one out. And I think just hearing about this Blood Moon, I'm going to get the second one out on September the 28th.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, and I just wanted to let you say a little bit more about the book, if there's anything that you see this particular edition, the first one, Science Revealed, about. I mean, you're dealing with different questions of truth and science, and also how inspiration happens. And one of the things you do, which I know Majo appreciates too, is you know, there's a few kind of stories that people talk about scientists getting their visionary inspiration. We know the dream of the snake for the benzene ring. There's a handful that people refer to, but you give like four times as many as I've ever read before.
I really started to go,
there's something really about this blast from the blue.
Yeah, one of the things I like to say too about the science stuff, you're right, I did a lecture on the occult origins of scientific theory, and people don't know this, but the scientific method came essentially from Descartes having a dream. Like, that's where all these scientists say, like, oh, you can't, dreams are garbage, whatever, paranormal is garbage. But the method, the scientific method comes from Descartes' dream. It's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. No, I wasn't familiar with that. There's plenty of examples, really. I think what I find most interesting in that is when you get what they call simultaneous discovery. So, for example, you have things like Newton discovered a number of different things, and we're not really sure about his process of doing it. He had his own compulsive investigations into the apocalypse, 4,500 pages on the subject. But he came up with gravity, and he came up with calculus in the same year, which was 1666. And it was the year, it was just after a comet, it was just after the second of two comets in 2 years. And he'd fled London because he knew, like all astronomers at the time, knew that comets meant that God was angry. So he fled off to his retreat and came up with these ideas. And one of them, gravity, well, calculus is particularly interesting because it opens up a whole new space, a whole new conceptual space of maths in motion. A whole new way of seeing the world, which is what an apocalypse is about. But he didn't tell anyone about it. He kept it to himself. He kept gravity to himself until, I think it was Edmund Halley, if I'm not mistaken, when he had a hunch that Newton knew something that he wasn't letting on to, because he used to replace his maths with conventional maths, his calculus. And Leibniz then discovered calculus a few years after him, and that put Newton into a paranoid frenzy. And that's just one of the examples of where these ideas really seem to have their own agenda. These game-changing ideas have an agenda. Another example is William Alfred Wallace's independent discovery of the laws of natural selection. So Darwin had been working on them for 10 years, more than 10 years, and he was scared to publish something so shocking to contemporary perspectives. And so he was sitting on his research, and he got a package from one of his correspondents, who was a naturalist collecting in the field. And this poor chap had been in the Malay Peninsula and had contracted malaria, and he spent 3 days in a malarial fever. And in those 3 days, he basically understood the theory of natural selection and its consequences for the world. And he sent this theory off to Darwin. He didn't realize that Darwin was working on the same thing. And Darwin, you know, hurried up and published the following year. So quite often when these new ideas which open up new spaces of thought and new scales, they all seem to happen at the same time. The Rubik's Cube is another one. Rubik's Cube was being worked on by three independent inventors in different parts of the world, and Rubik happened to get there first. But you think about, I mean, the Rubik's Cube, it just sounds like a toy, but there's a machine for sequential thinking which has passed through, you know, countless millions of hands and, you know, later had an impact on brains all over the world. And
that's a wonderful example. And I also like that it's more current. I mean, it's so interesting to think about these issues of game changing ideas happening sort of simultaneously or in synchrony in different minds. In terms of what's happening now, I mean, now there's this incredible intense focus on ingenuity, on novelty, on new models, on, you know, new ways of applying mathematics and science to large data sets that are describing increasingly everything that's going on in the world. I mean, there's so many books seeking innovation, seeking inspiration. I mean, it's you know, out of the box time, you know, that like in so many different fields. And it's interesting to think about what's missing, like what are the kinds of inspirations, or what are the modes of inviting inspiration that we're sort of missing in our moment, that seems at once very willing and interested in revolutionary ideas, and then at the same time extremely hidebound and depressingly locked into very set ways of thinking about the world. So how do you think, what are the ways in which people can sort of seize this moment and try to really get to those to those genuine inspirations?
I think if you're locked into a rationalistic mode of understanding the world, then you need to do a little bit more reading of the scientific literature. I think that's one thing that is really important, because skepticism, for example, skepticism in the initial original sense of the word is about the nature of knowledge, whether something can be known or not, or somewhat proved or not. So if we're going to be genuine skeptics, then we need to be skeptics of all kinds of ideas, including those of the scientific community. So I think that's one thing. To open the door to revelation, you need to keep that internal editor at bay. And that's another thing about writing, actually. You can't do your editing while you're writing, otherwise you'll never get the writing written. Obviously one of the very easy ways to open the door is by taking all kinds of intriguing substances. But again, it needs to be done with a certain degree of care. If you want to be taking psychedelics, then you would profit from opening up a space in that for silence.
Well, and that's interesting too, because there are some scholars who seem to put forward that Isaac Newton was ingesting certain substances when he came to those specific revelations about calculus and gravity both. There is some information leading in that direction. But also to add to that as well, like, I mean, you can see that inspiration opening to and getting into those subjects. But as Eric pointed out, you know, there will be certain, you know, histories or things that can lead into the inspiration of this. And if we look at the esoteric nature of it, you can also see that Isaac Newton was studying alchemy and astrology. Like, he was in the dance of those subjects. And even, like, Leibniz, like you said, who also discovered calculus, I mean, that came to him from a Jesuit friend who went to China and studied the I Ching. Like, there was a lot of evidence that pointed that it came from that. So sometimes that inspiration is some kind of combination of, like you said, engaging in those medicines, but also looking at, like, you know, connecting to the larger history of consciousness in general, like what other people
exactly.
have looked at. Yeah, totally.
And, I mean, Newton's that year, 1666, was the year that he spent most of his time doing alchemical experiments. He was on a real intense alchemical tip at that particular point in his career. And in fact, that's why some of the critics say that he went mad and he's been ingesting mercury, and that's why he came up with all this crazy apocalyptic stuff. But no, I think following your passions is really where it's at. And Newton was had a real capacity to follow single-mindedly his object of study. He was extremely antisocial for one thing, and he only ever once tried to throw a dinner party, and apparently he slipped off at some point and was found. He was found hours later, hunched over his desk at his work. So yeah, these kind of you know, if you want to penetrate into mysteries, it requires a certain giving into your obsessions, I think.
Yeah, I think obsessions like that are actually a great gift. I think one of the troubles that I see, and you know, maybe it's other people don't experience it as much as I do with our kind of internetworked world of constant pings and URLs and opportunities and data and da da da. This sort of overwhelm is that it's actually kind of harder to listen to or find your own obsession. Or to invite it in, to recognize it, because it's so easy to be distracted by these sort of collective forces. Now, obviously, something's going on there too. Something, you know, that our time is pointing us towards forms of collective being and response that maybe we haven't had before, and that's part of the creativity of this moment, or even the obsession of our moment as well. But personally, I find it sometimes difficult to sort of recover, plug back into my own obsessions.
Yeah, there's an angel of the internet as well as an angel of the library, but there's also plenty of demons. I think probably more on the internet than there are in the library.
Say that again.
There's an angel of the internet, the same way there's an angel of the library, but I think there's many more demons on the internet than there are in the library.
I like that. That's really good. That's really good. So we got to wrap it up here, Reverend. I wanted to let you point people to a website they can check out what you're doing. We didn't talk about so much other stuff, your politics and all these kinds of things you're doing.
Okay, I can point people to mine, which is nemuzen.co.uk, and I can also point them to Psychedelic Press UK, which is my publisher, and it's also putting together anthologies of psychedelic writing, including some of the people who've been on your show, for example, Robert Tindall and Neil Goldsmith, and people like that. So that's a good place to look. I've got an article coming up in there, which is in the next anthology, which is about, it was meant to be a comparative history, but it ended up talking about my illness quite a lot and about scientific perspectives on shamanic taboos, the taboos in the academy and the taboos in the jungle, and how the one prevents the study of the other. So that's a good place to start looking.
Wonderful. Yeah, I just want to remind people, Nemuzend, nemusend.co.uk. Hey, Reverend, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Brilliant. Thank you both very much.
All right. From me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.